You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club, a home for those interested in international trade, shipping, procurement, logistics, and air freight. In fact, all things supply chain in the Americas, Asia, and beyond. This podcast is brought to you by your host, Mike King, and produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a global 3PL that specializes in managing logistics to, from, and within the Asia-Pacific region.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Freight Buyers Club, which, as you've just heard, is produced with the support of Demerco Express Group. I'm Mike King, and please do follow this podcast on your platform of choice, including YouTube, where you'll also find loads of additional shorts and news insights. You can also subscribe and listen at www.thefreightbuyersclub.com. Today, we've got some great guests in the shape of the Wall Street Journal's Paul Page, the Journal of Commerce's Michael Angel, and container shipping guru John McCown. We're looking at the latest grave threat to global trade, one that has been influencing the decisions of US shippers for much of this year, at least for the smart ones, paying attention to the advice of experts on this podcast. This latest supply chain shock is looming right now and getting wider attention.
The nation's consumer supply chain faces severe disruptions if dock workers at ports along the East and Gulf Coasts go on strike, and the deadline is quickly approaching.
The threat of strikes by more than 85,000 dock workers represented by the International Longshoremen's Association, the ILA, and deployed at container terminals on the U.S. East and Gulf Coast ports is getting very close to being realized. Port interests represented by the United States Maritime Alliance, the USMX, which is basically an alliance of container carriers, direct employees and port associations, have failed to reach an agreement on a new master contract for ILA dock workers when the current contract ends on 30th of September. And ILA President Harold Daggett has not exactly been beating about the bush on what he intends his members to do.
The ILA most definitely will hit the streets on October 1st. If we don't get the kind of contract we deserve.
Certainly no lack of clarity there, and as we'll hear, there is almost no time left for the parties to step back from the brink. Today, and we're recording 24th of September, just to timestamp this, we'll be examining all elements of this mess, not least what shippers can expect in terms of pricing, disruption, politics, and wider global ramifications. Because I have no doubt, any strike covering over half of the US's container handling capacity will have a domino effect on global trade flows, and many of those supply chains are already stretched by knock-on effects from the Red Sea crisis. To find out what's going on right now, I'm delighted to be joined by a former colleague of mine of some time distant. He's the current senior editor at the Journal of Commerce. Michael Angel, welcome to the Freight Buyers Club.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike. Yeah, we worked together prior to the pandemic. It seems like a whole world has changed since then, right?
How it has changed. And this is what we're going to discuss today, just one of many things that we've been both covering over these last few years. The ILA, you've been on point on this story at JOC. A strike would basically close operations at more than half of US container port facilities. In your words, what are the implications of this for the US logistics and distribution systems, and widening it out slightly for the US economy that depends on them, of course?
Well, just to make it clear, it won't shut down the ports entirely. If you're taking a cruise ship, you're going to be okay. The ILA will still remove your luggage from the ship, and military cargoes are still going to move. But yeah, you're right. Container terminals in 14 ports along the East Coast and the Gulf Coast are going to shut down essentially on October 1st because of this stalemate that's happening with the ILA and the USMX. And as far as the economic impact, well, just to put it in perspective, the Port of New York and New Jersey alone handles $200 billion worth of cargo, most of that containerized, and they're the biggest port, of course, on the East Coast. And so for them to shut down, if that's just $200 billion loan, then you're going to add in Baltimore, Norfolk, Savannah, Charleston. So the numbers are going to add up. Now, of course, a lot of shippers, they already brought in cargo. They were anticipating this. I guess they were a little bit more pessimistic on this than me. So hopefully we'll have enough stuff. to ride out the strike. But of course, you know, certain goods, perishable goods, bananas are, the banana market might get kind of tight for a little while. Anything that's perishable, anything that's sort of doesn't have a long shelf life that needs to be brought in by a container ship, those are at risk right now.
We'll come back to exactly, obviously the banana imports are huge into the East Coast, and obviously they require, normally they would require reefers, which need to be manned and monitored.
Yeah.
But just coming back to the negotiations, we heard from Harold Daggett was quite forthright in saying that strike's going to happen on October the 1st. But can you just give us a brief summation of what's the current status of those negotiations and what has made getting this contract over the line so difficult? Or maybe to put it another way, what is it that the ILA wants that the USMX is refusing to give?
Sure. Well, just by way of quick history, this started out with the best of intentions. I mean, they started negotiating this upcoming contract 2 years ago. And they actually want to avoid the problems that we're seeing out on the West Coast with labor actions and with red tagging of equipment and the other things that were just kind of blocking up container movements there during the contract negotiations. So they started, what was it? The ILA put out a notice back in October telling its locals to start sorting out their contract negotiations. That's basically for any sort of local work rules, local pensions, local health benefits. And then after that, they're going to proceed to the master contract, which the big deal in there is, of course, all the wages for the ports up and down the East and Gulf Coast. And so they started out with the best of intentions, trying to work out a deal early on, but local agreements, they got bogged down by issues related to staffing, by issues related to healthcare. So they kind of at least put that to the side. But the big issue right now that's holding up the contract talks are the wages. Now, Harold Daggett, the president of the ILA, he is looking for a $5 per hour increase for each of the 6 years of the new master contract. So that would be a total of $30 wage increase over the contract's term through 2030. And that would represent about, I think it's like a 77% increase in the top wage scale for longshore workers over 6 years. And, you know, that's unprecedented.
That's a huge increase, even higher than the ILW strike settlement that was a year ago, right?
That's a huge increase. And Harold did stake a lot of his reputation, or at least sort of stuck to the position that he wants a better deal than the ILWU. Just to put it in perspective, for the previous two collective bargaining agreements, the ILA, they basically agreed to $1 per hour wage increases over that term. So over the last 12 years, ILA wages have increased all of $12. So now, especially after the pandemic and the fact that the longshore workers were working through it and the volumes that they saw, you know, they feel that this is their time to strike while the iron's hot and get a strong increase. Now, the way to think about that, of course, is that, well, the ILWU, they got a 32% increase. I forget exactly what it is, but union auto workers, maybe they got something like 40% over their four-year term. Boeing machinists, they were offered 25% over 4 years, but now they're on strike. And I think Boeing's going to, they want to sweeten their pot to like 30%. But these are at least examples of what kinds of wage increases that management in general has been looking to pay their union workforces. So when the USMX is getting hit with something like a 78% ask to increase wages, they're balking. This, you know, I mean, they're looking at this as like, no union is getting this. Your counterparts in the West Coast didn't get this. And so from what I understand, the USMX, they're offering something. It would be better than the ILWU. I believe it's about a 38%. So it's essentially half. So they're willing to offer $250 per hour wage increase for each year. So that's basically the biggest gulf between the two right now.
That sounds like a job I would take. Michael, so just to put this in perspective, right, in terms of we're talking on the 24th of September, we're a week away from when Harold Daggett says a strike could start 1st of October. Is there any way this deal can be done? Because From how I understand how the ILA operates, it's not simply that they'll just come up with a master contract. There's local chapter agreements that need to be in place. So there's quite a lot of internal talks that would have to happen before they could sign a master contract if the USMX came back with a better deal. Is that correct? Because it then sounds like it's almost impossible for a deal to be done in the next week.
Well, you know, never say never, but yeah, I don't think that there can be a deal reached within this week. I've at least sort of heard off record that the USMX has gone back to the ILA and asked for, you know, offered any other concessions other than wages. Basically, we'll give you anything else you want other than the 78%. But Harold is really, he's put a line in the sand on this about what kind of wage increases that he wants. Now, there could be sort of other concessions, other types of arrangements that are going on. One thing that's definitely come up in the last couple months with regard to the ILA is that their list of asks that they have from the USMX has increased. So they want a better container royalty, which is what pays for the health and vacation benefits. There's been an issue that they brought up with regard to Maersk and APM terminals in Mobile with regard to their use of technology, which I understand there might also be issues with staffing down there, meaning that the ILA wants to hire more longshore workers at the Port of Mobile. They want bigger longshore gangs down there. There's also an issue with the contract now with regard to the protections against automation. The ILA sort of wants basically a harder line against automation, basically even semi-automation. They're against it. And the implication there is that, well, it's basically going to almost freeze terminals for what their hiring is for right now. You're not going to be able to implement any technology, any efficiencies over the next 6 years. They are drawing sort of a hard line on anything that might affect jobs, anything that might affect the work that they do. So I just really think that I don't see that the USMX is going to concede all these other points or is going to meet their wage demands in, what, 6 days?
There's one silver bullet out there that people have been referencing or hoping for their salvation, certainly for US shippers who listen to this podcast, and that's a political intervention, essentially. And it's going to be very interesting how the Biden administration plays this going into those presidential elections on the 5th of November, because a shutdown won't play particularly well to voters. So just for listeners, a bit of background, the main political tool available is the Labor Management Relations Act of 1947, better known as the Taft-Hartley Act. This is a federal law that can be used to restrict the activities and power of labor unions in very specific situations. So far, and despite the biggest alliance I have ever seen of trade associations campaigning vigorously for the Biden administration to use Taft-Hartley, they have so far ruled it out. I guess the thinking is they don't want to upset labor ahead of these elections. It's maybe worth throwing in. The Biden administration did sign a bill to block unions, including the powerful Teamsters Union, from striking against railroads back in 2022. So in terms of union goodwill to play with, they don't have much of it. Seems to me, Michael, the Democrats are in a bind. They can't really win. If they allow the strikes to go ahead, the economy could be crippled coming into those elections. But if they block it, they lose the support of labor. Is that right?
Yeah, no, it's definitely interesting how it's playing out, but maybe it's not too much of a surprise. I mean, during all the West Coast labor issues, the Biden administration seemed to be a little bit more vocal about its interventions and about sending in Acting Secretary Julie Hsu to oversee the talks, and as well as send in their pork czar to help kickstart things. How that played out with the ILA, though, was not good. Harold actually called out Biden basically for siding with management during the West Coast labor talks. Basically, his view is that the Biden administration kind of forced a deal on the West Coast longshore workers at their expense. So Harold's been very adamant about he doesn't want any intervention by the White House. He wants to just keep it between the ILA and the USMX. And this is despite the fact that, yeah, Biden administration has been a friend to unions, and Democrats are traditionally friends of labor. Now, Harold's been, I don't know, I guess maybe on the fence or is still deciding sort of which way the political winds are blowing. He mentioned that he's going to meet with the other candidate for president down in Mar-a-Lago. And even though, despite former President Trump being not the most friendly to unions, I think Harold's reckoning now is that, well, he's not looking to endorse a presidential candidate. He's looking for a presidential candidate to endorse him. And the political calculation is that he's kind of got the wind at his back. I mean, both candidates, they're vying for the labor vote. There is a lot of pro-US sentiment out there about labor. So ocean carriers that are based in Copenhagen or Hamburg or wherever, they don't exactly have any political friends out here. They're a good whipping boy for either candidate, any of these non-US companies. So Harold feels that he has a nationalist sentiment behind him. He has the pro-labor sentiment behind him.
Yeah, I mean, it's very clear that the USMX could end up getting a political kick in because foreign carriers are going to be a very, very easier target if the economy is closed down. And we've already had them they've been in the crosshairs a bit during the COVID pandemic for profiteering as well. FMC powers were ramped up as a result of that. There's one little scenario I'll run past you, and I unashamedly stole this from your colleague, Ari Ash, who posted it on LinkedIn. I thought it was very interesting. He said one way this could play out was a little bit like we saw in Canada 2 months ago when unions closed down the railroads briefly before the government stepped in. And all that happened in about within 24 hours or so. Could Biden's way out be to let the chaos start on that October 1st wire if that's what Daggett follows through on, like it seems like he will, but perhaps then intervened, maybe not let things get too out of hand?
I guess there's the potential there. I'm not a big Taft-Hartley expert, but the way that I understand that it can work is that it would force both sides basically to go back to the negotiating table. Basically, USMX's position is that the ILA is just refusing to negotiate. So potentially Biden could invoke Taft-Hartley to say, okay, you got to at least go back to negotiating. You got to at least talk to them and, can't be trading all these barbs back and forth. As far as an actual strike, I'm not too sure if Taft-Hartley would be that effective on it. As I understand Taft-Hartley, that basically bars any sort of illegal strike. So that would be a secondary boycott, these kinds of things. But once the contract expires on October 1st, the longshore workers are free to strike. The clause that they have in the current contract to not strike, that expires. So they're basically free to do what they want on October 1st. So their strikes technically wouldn't be illegal.
Just thinking about how damaging this was, I spoke to Torsten Hartmann, Senior Director of Trade Management for the Trans-Pacific at Hapag-Lloyd a few weeks back on episode 23 of this podcast. And we were talking about strikes in general, but particularly what might happen if the ILA struck. His rule of thumb is that every day of a union strike at a port takes a week to clean up because cargo gets stuck, ships get delayed, empties are out of position. So even a matter of hours could make a big difference in terms of the ramifications for global supply chains for the US economy. Just pivoting slightly, ahead of these strikes, we're sort of getting a view of what container lines are doing. They're emitting port calls. They're trying to move cargo inland as quickly as possible. Carriers are already issuing warnings of various surcharges for October. Obviously, they've got to give a 30-day notice period to the Federal Maritime Commission. I love the titles of these surcharges. We've got work disruption surcharges, strike disruption surcharges, emergency. We're going to have a whole load more as well, I can guarantee it. Very,
Work
very creative.
interruption surcharge, work disruption surcharge. Yep.
It's very creative. Ports are extending gate hours so shippers can collect cargoes. Is any of this going to help shippers get cargo through some of these major hubs over the next week? And what happens if people do get cargo stuck there, especially if it's reefer cargoes? What happens? It's just going to get damaged. It's going to be lost until this is resolved.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, you're right about the reefer cargo. I mean, ports are particularly notifying shippers that there's not even going to be mechanics or maintenance personnel to monitor reefers. So you better get that cargo out of here, or at least your bananas or beer, they're going to spoil. And you're right. Basically, this last week, I mean, this is sort of a scrambling week. Ports, they're open later than ever. I mean, the port out here in New Jersey, the main marine terminals, they're going to be open 2 hours later just to try and move as much cargo as they can. And the port's already been jammed with everybody bringing in. So it's going to be, so it's even more jammed. I mean, the truck queues are just out of control right now. So ports are going to try and clear out as much cargo as they can. They're trying to bring in ships, trying to work them as quickly as possible. But yeah, I mean, on midnight of October 1st, the terminals, the truck gates will be closed. And from what I understand, the ocean carriers, they're just going to let their ships just sit there in the hopes that maybe it'll be open in a week or something like that. But yeah, I mean, there's going to be a backlog. And just depending on how long this strike takes, what was there at one point out here in New Jersey, there was about 20 ships, something like that, anchored. So it can get big.
We saw in the pandemic how quickly those ship queues can build up, and then they take an awful long time to clear afterwards, which obviously will have ramifications right through the fourth quarter and into the contracting season next year. We've already had one container line, Evergreen, hint that Trans-Pacific contract rates might well be affected by an ILA strike, such as the nature of these stretched supply chains already. Again, that won't play very well politically in the US. Just before we finish up, how are the railroads and truckers approaching all this? Have they been issuing any advice for shippers? What's their preparations been?
Yeah, so with the rail, they're going to be working up till September 30th, meaning that they'll be bringing in cargo or taking out cargo up until then. You know, basically all activity is still going to take place on Monday. But yeah, on October 1st, the railroads are not going to be able to access the ports. They're already telling export cargo that it's probably getting cut off about now. So that would be all the ag stuff that maybe comes from the Chicago or Midwest. That stuff is probably sitting in a rail yard right now and should get out to the port here by about September 30th or any other East Coast or Gulf Coast port by then. But after today or tomorrow, that's going to be it. You know, you're going to have to hang on to your export box. Some of the railroads, they said that they'll accept the rail ramps, the yards, those will still be open, and they'll take in an export box or your container up to the point that their yards are full, and then you're going to have to hold on to them. As far as the truckers I've spoken to out here, what they're doing is maybe if their BCO, if their shipper doesn't have the warehouse space for a container, they'll do what's called pre-pull. Basically, it's like, you know, we'll take custody of the container, we'll hold on to it in our yard until you're ready, Mr. Shipper, Ms. Shipper, to receive it. So they're doing a lot of pre-pulls right now, but of course, they only have so much room in their yards. So they're trying to accommodate the BCOs and try to get as much cargo as they can off the docks prior to October 1st. And it's going to be interesting to see just kind of what's left. You won't have to worry about paying demurrage, but you won't know when you'll be able to get your cargo.
It's certainly going to be interesting. We're going to be sticking with this subject, and we've got a few great guests coming up. We'll be looking at a few different angles. But for now, Michael Angel, Senior Editor at Journal of Commerce, thanks for joining me today on the Freight Buyers Club.
Happy to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Of course, how this plays out for US businesses and for the US economy will be absolutely critical. I spoke to Paul Page, Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal's Logistics Report, and I started by asking him how damaging an ILA strike could be for US industry, how disruptive it could be for the upcoming holiday season, and what it all means for US trade with the rest of the world.
Well, certainly. I mean, it's, for one thing, it's going to throw schedules and shipping and all of that off schedule and kind of create more disarray, as if the maritime sector hasn't had enough of that in the past. I mean, it's just going to displace ships, displace schedules. We've already seen a couple of people, I think Ocean Network Express, as Jeremy Nixon said, that he expects ships just to wait, just to sit off the coast of New York, New Jersey, waiting it out. So schedules are going to be thrown completely out of whack. I mean, there's going to be that. That's going to have an impact on global supply chains right there. As far as the impact on the U.S. economy, I think some of the impact on the holidays and all that might be a bit overstated. I think people are going to have their Christmas trees. They're going to get their garlands. They're going to get their menorahs. All of that stuff is kind of in place. You know, little children will have their Christmas. That's not really going to be much affected. It comes fairly late in the season. People have been bringing in lots, just enormous volumes, especially to the West Coast so far. And so I think most shelves are going to be stocked. Certainly the impact, if we see something that lasts a few days, I think the impact will be, as the journalist word goes that I've enjoyed lately, muted over 3 or 4 days. Throw schedules off, but I don't think you're going to be lacking for the Mattel toys and all of that. If it goes on for 2 or 3 weeks, the impact on the economy obviously grows, and I think grows exponentially.
And so then it becomes an issue for how Wall Street markets are looking at the U.S. economy or U.S. companies that are affected by this.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's going to affect anybody. I mean, trade is such a huge part of the economy. Now, some of the economy has started to shift. I mean, we've seen some really interesting numbers. I had in my newsletter the other day that imports into Charleston, South Carolina, not the biggest port in the country by any stretch, but still a significant import, was going down. It's been going down. It fell in August. In the meantime, boxes going into LA, Long Beach, into Seattle have been up 40% year over year and growing 9 to 10% from month to month. So clearly, you know, we hear anecdotally, and clearly we're seeing in the numbers, that people are shipping away from the East Coast right now.
Yeah, I think that's been in stream for a lot of the year. People have had this on the radar. Is it going to happen was the big thing, and now it looks like it will. What are the political implications? Just quickly, Paul, are Democrats hand-tied here, do you think?
Look, President Biden has already said he doesn't intend to invoke the Taft-Hartley Act, which is the federal law that allows him to intervene in strikes. The pressure for that to happen is going to grow. He's got a very tough political situation. It's a dance here. He's a very pro-union president, but in fact, he'll be faced with a situation where he's got something that's going to affect the economy, hurt the economy in the weeks leading up to the presidential election. So there's going to be a lot of pressure for him to act. Anyone who knows what will happen, I have to say, doesn't really know what they're talking about. Obviously, these are pressures.
I fully agree. When we talk about this, it's mainly framed when we look at imports for retailers, for manufacturers. Agricultural exporters aren't happy as well. Many of them are maybe facing higher tariff regimes at some point down the road. Many sell to China. A possible strike is a big blow to them, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to upset capacity. It's going to, there are a lot of supply chains. Basically, the U.S. is divided up at the Mississippi. So things going off the West Coast, going a lot through Oakland, through Seattle, these things are going to continue. But there's an entire swath of the American economy that ships out from the East Coast and the Gulf Coast. Those companies are going to have a lot of trouble. You can't really change, redirect an export supply chain as easily as you can, I think, an import supply chain. I mean, these are, in many cases in the U.S., low commodity goods, farming goods, agricultural stuff. And so they're going to have a hard time getting that stuff out.
Paul Page, Bureau Chief of the Wall Street Journal's Logistics Report. Thanks for joining me today on the Freight Buyers Club.
Thank you, Mike.
Next up, after a short message from our sponsor, Demerco Express Group, I'm talking to John McCown, who has 4 decades of experience investing and operating container shipping, as well as serving as a senior fellow at the Center for Maritime Strategy.
This podcast is proudly produced in partnership with Demerco Express Group, a trusted provider of global shipping and contract logistics services in Asia, Europe, and North America. Demerco's particular strength is in Asia, where it gives shippers the freight capacity and local market expertise to streamline freight movements to and from the region, particularly for Trans-Pacific lanes. With 130 forwarding and logistics locations across China, India, and Southeast Asia, Demerco connects Asia with the world like no other global 3PL. You are listening to the Freight Buyers Club.
Welcome back. As trailed, I'm joined by John McCown, who's been there and got the T-shirt when it comes to container shipping operations, analysis, and investment. He's current senior fellow at the Center for Maritime Strategy, which is the U.S. Navy League's think tank. Welcome back to the Freight Buyers Club, John.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be with you. Always enjoy talking about freight with you.
Thank you very much. John, so if this strike happens, it's going to be the first major one by the ILA since, I think, 1977. So what sort of volumes are we talking about being held up each day or each week if all of these East Coast and Gulf Coast container ports are closed? Because we're talking more than half America's container terminals being shut off, aren't we? And are there any lessons from history that will help us understand how this might impact US freight systems and international supply chains?
Well, yeah, first, to start off with the numbers, it'd be a very big deal. It's much bigger than the West Coast. To kind of put it into perspective, you're talking about 59,000 TEUs a day, the equivalent of 411,000 TEUs a week going over those ports. And you can extend what that means in value to something like $3.1 billion a day of commerce and $22 billion a week. So it's a big deal. And if you have a coastwide strike, it'll quite frankly be bigger than anything that we contemplated on the West Coast, both in terms of the volume and kind of the diversity of lanes that are involved. It's been a long time. The ILA traditionally has not been the one that has striked. It was the ILWU that was more active. You have to go back 22 years to the last actual strike by the ILWU on the West Coast. And that was 10 days, and it ended with the Taft-Hartley Act being put in place, as I recall, by President Bush. But that was a mess. Unfortunately, this is looking like it could be a bigger mess. Not only is there more volume, but there's also much more outbound loads relative to the inbound. And those all translate into jobs. You also have a much broader diversity of trade lanes that are involved. When you have a situation involving the West Coast, you know, it involves lots of trade lanes, but it's primarily focused on Asia. And it was a fairly easy alternative. And we saw people doing coastal switching to move freight by water to the East Coast. And if that freight was destined to end up on the East Coast or even the Midwest, that would often be a less costly way of doing it anyway. It wouldn't be as quick. You don't have that kind of easy alternative here. First, and you also are involving a lot more trade lanes. This would involve a major transatlantic trade lane, trade involving South America and the Middle East. So all of that kind of comes together to make this a much bigger deal and a much bigger deal for the U.S. And with that, it would kind of become a global problem. If you take all of those ports and the container business they do, by my calculations, you're looking at 16% of the container miles in the world. So it's a big deal.
It certainly is a big deal. From your operational experience, can you just explain how even a shore closure might impact liner networks and equipment logistics? So what I mean by that is, when will ships get back to Asia or back to Europe? What are the implications for box availability? And how does this all have knock-on effects on service reliability outside of the US?
Well, container shipping is really kind of a continuous system. When it's working in the way it should be, everything is moving and there's constant handoffs, you know, more than a dozen times typically in a movement. If there's a coastwide strike, that stops everything. And so you immediately see some immediate effects. And because right now there aren't ready alternatives, I would expect the initial step would be that ships would just wait at anchor. There would be some attempts, presumably, at rerouting. But when you look at the volume of freight that is involved, any rerouting would quickly lead to congestion in those ports, which would almost be as bad as kind of sitting at anchor. And so even a few days, I mean, we saw, if you go way back when to the work stoppage on the West Coast, after it ends, in many cases is where the real congestion or problems begin, because then there's a bunching up. And all of a sudden, what is normally a system where everything is spread out and everything is kind of moving as it should, it's coming in big bunches. And that just becomes real problematic for everybody involved.
So it could take a long time to unravel, even if it's a relatively short strike, just because of the sheer number of ships that might be arriving on all of those different trades. So very different to that threat on the West Coast, which is a lot more trans-Pacific based. What are the major industries that are likely to be impacted, John, on the import and export side? I know you look at these numbers in great detail.
Well, when I was asked that question yesterday by a reporter, I guess it was somewhat flippant, but I said everything will be impacted. That, depending on how long it goes on, almost every industry in the country has some linkage to moving either their products or components of their products in containers. And then on top of that, obviously, consumers, almost everything that they buy in their everyday shopping, you know, moves kind of by container. So that being said, there are a couple of industries that jump out to me, perhaps with the most pronounced impact and immediate, would be automobiles. And there I'm really talking mainly the parts of automobiles or the components that move in containers. Now, I think we just passed last year where the majority of cars sold in the U.S. Or built in the U.S. were assembled by foreign-based manufacturers. And most of that actually is in the form of, it's called CKD, complete knockdown. And those are specialized containers that move engine blocks and sub-assemblies, mainly from Asia, that are assembled in plants here. And that's the factories are designed to be kind of just in time. With those shipments stopping, those plants will immediately shut down. We saw some of that. That was one of the first impacts I recall in the pandemic was Hyundai plants here. There was kind of a problem related to that. Another industry that jumps off the page to me, and this would be both inbound and outbound, is agriculture. Of course, with the fresh fruit and vegetables and other products, it requires continuing to move. And that would be a rather immediate effect, not only in terms of what consumers consume and eat every day, but exports. One of our biggest exports in containers is agricultural products. So those are two that really kind of jump out to me.
How are the liners approaching this? Are we seeing the COVID playbook being rolled out again, where it's like, do you know what? It's not that bad if all our ships get stuck on the East Coast because it tightens the global supply chain demand balance. Our profits will go up and the cost will essentially be borne by shippers. Is that what we'll see? That's how some people would characterize it. Not me, of course.
Well, that's perhaps a cynical view, but one that the recent past is shown might, putting aside what carriers want to happen, the facts have shown both during the pandemic and confirmed during the Red Sea situation, when there are major constraints in capacity, as there were in both of those, we've seen pricing skyrocket. And so clearly, this work stoppage will lead to higher costs for carriers. That being said, it's, again, going from what happened in the past, and most particularly, most recently in the Red Sea situation, whatever cost increase they had, there were more than mitigated by pricing. The Red Sea remains the catalyst that had the industry turn from a loss situation in the last quarter of 2023 to being profitable in the first quarter and kind of growing profits, and they'll be even higher in the third quarter. So that is a very interesting dynamic in this situation, and a dynamic that I would say, unfortunately, does not lend itself to a quicker resolution. My observation, and I'm not a labor person, I don't know the ins and outs of labor negotiations, but I do know at a distance when you have a strike, what is typically going on is kind of a shared pain or pain on both sides. You know, the workers aren't working and aren't being paid what they were paid. The company isn't manufacturing its widgets or whatever and are suffering there. And it's that kind of shared pain that has a way of pushing the two sides together and reaching a settlement. If one were to believe that the impact of the capacity reduction, which is what immediately happens if you have such a strike like this, would lead to pricing that would be more than mitigating those costs, you have an unusual dynamic thrown into the situation. I go back to that calculation that I referenced of 16% being the kind of the tie-in to these ports in terms of global container miles. And why that's important, that is literally right at twice the capacity impact that the Red Sea situation had. With that longer voyage, it basically sucked up 8% of the, or contracted 8% of the global capacity. So the East Coast, if you were dealing with the hypothetical port-wide or coast-wide strike, would be double that. And so the impact would be quite immediate and quite significant on pricing.
Just going back to the COVID playbook idea, I sort of threw it out there in jest a little bit, but I think from a carrier point of view, this is something that could be thrown at them because they're in this, I don't know if it's a poison chalice position, but as members of the USMX, which is the counterparty that's supposed to meet ILA demands, if they're intending not to meet those ILA demands, and we heard from Michael Angel earlier that they are quite significant by any measure, and I'm sure most people who listen to them would find them, well, over 70% pay rise is quite significant in anyone's job. I'll put it like that. But some people, and I could see this playing out politically, might point the finger at carriers if then carriers are seen to be making large profits out of bottlenecks that affect the US economy in a detrimental way leading into elections. Is there a danger there for carriers that they're in this sort of bind between what's reasonable for the USMX versus what's politically damaging for them or maybe regulatory damaging at some point in the future if they're seen to be profiteering, even if they're not, if you see what I mean?
I do. And you make a good point. And I'm sure they're cognizant of that. And I think they're still, they were painted during the pandemic by politicians in terms that they don't want to see a repeat of. I guess because this situation has a little bit of a difference where they'll be pointing to the union and pointing to what they think are unreasonable demands. And it seems to go beyond the wage. It includes issues related to automation, which is a key issue on both sides. So I guess when you take all of those factors into account, and then you start to realize or start to think that the carriers, that the very effect of this would push pricing up, I think they would, and I would expect them to readily point to real issues. You know, this isn't a situation where the demands on the other side are something that everybody would say they should readily accept. If it were that, then you really could say, wow, you know, carriers, you seem to be just doing this just to cause this capacity constraint. But you do bring up a good point, and I'm sure the carriers are going to be, to the extent that this goes on, attempting to get their side of the story out. And it would seem like they have some points that they could make.
So many ifs and buts when we don't know if a strike will actually go ahead. It's all about scenarios at the moment. One of the big issues for many shippers during COVID was detention and demurrage charges. Carriers thus far, as we're talking a week ahead of when a possible strike might start on the 1st of October, they've issued information on how D&D charges will accrue where terminal closures prevent pickups and deliveries of boxes. Now, the US Federal Maritime Commission and Chairman Daniel Maffey is a regular listener and former guest on this podcast. The FMC has issued the following warning, and I'll quote, FMC regulations require that demurrage and detention fees serve as legitimate financial incentives to encourage cargo movement. Pursuant to these requirements, the commission will scrutinize any demurrage and detention charges assessed during terminal closures. So, that's a shot across the bows for container lines. But is the message that you'd give to shippers, check the fine print on D&D and other charges on contracts with container lines, and maybe make sure you know exactly what you're going to be charged for if your cargo gets caught up in all this?
Well, I think the FMC has done a good job of focusing on this area and kind of making it clear that these sort of charges have to be tied into, I think they use the term, the fluidity of the container continuing to move. And if you have a situation where a container terminal is congested such that a shipper can neither pick up a load or return an empty, that basic condition doesn't seem to exist. I think with the scrutiny by the FMC and the refinement of the information that should be shared, I don't think shippers need to be overly concerned that there's something specific in their contract, because I think all of these kind of tie into their tariff. But it is something that, and I think that whole area, shippers are appropriately much more aware of that. But, you know, it seems like the FMC, this has been an area of scrutiny. And the statement you just read by the chairman of the FMC kind of underscores they're looking at this and watching it carefully.
John McCown, Senior Fellow at the Center for Maritime Strategy, thanks for joining me today on the Freight Buyers Club.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Mike.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Freight Buyers Club, produced in partnership with the Demerco Express Group. Please subscribe and follow on your platform of choice, or sign up for delivery to your inbox at thefreightbuyersclub.com. This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the fantastic editing of Karen Ball and Tom Matthews. And finally, Thank you all for listening. The next episode will be with you soon.